This is the WGBH Forum Network.
Okay. So as you saw, I convened a group of ministers and lay people because I said, you know, this is really your problem and your community, and I need your guidance. Here's what I've been confronted with, but I think it's up to you whether or not I should do anything, make any more concerted effort. So they agreed that we should, in fact, mark this unmarked cemetery. And as I said in the beginning, we were not able to get it marked. But, as you saw, Mrs. Britton was right there at every meeting saying, but we have this other cemetery. We have Love Cemetery. And it's the most beautiful place in the world. It's so peaceful out there. And before I die, I want us to be able to get back in there and clean the graves like we always used to do and have the women cooking in the morning while the men were cleaning out at the cemetery, and then everyone would gather at noon. They would bring the food out, and they'd sit under the trees, and they would have reunions and sing and pray in that old gospel, old-style gospel singing that you heard there, that they still sing over in East Texas. So it became a joy for me to go back and work with this community. It was like stepping into another world. Fortunately, I'd turned my back on my Western upbringing for about 20 years. Penguin has just issued a new edition of this book on the Black Madonna, Tar and the Black Madonna. It's called Longing for Darkness. So this just came out at the same time this one did. And that's sort of more of how, you know, it finally dawned on me that this tradition I was examining in European Catholicism was actually, it was a black woman, you know, being shown as honored and venerated. And this is a Roman Catholic tradition all over Europe. And that drew me in to really beginning to connect my work more specifically with issues of race and sensing that something else needed to happen. And what happened was Love Cemetery. So as I said, Mrs. Britton would come to our meetings, and even though we kept saying, well, no, we're trying to get the unmarked ground at Locust Grove, get a marker there, and she would say, well, when we get finished with that one, then maybe you can help with Love. And she was such a joyful, persistent presence that one evening I was over there and we had a meeting, and she said, well, you know, the next morning we could go out, I could show you the cemetery. And so Doris Vitato, whom you saw there as well, my dear friend, also wanted to go, because when Doris's mother died, she died not having been able to get back to clean her mother's grave. And I'll never forget Doris telling me that. I'd never heard of not being able to clean someone's grave, much less being stopped. So Doris's mother died without having been able to do that, and Doris wanted to see it. And as you saw, that was the first time she'd ever seen her great-grandfather's grave, Ohio Taylor. So quickly it became apparent, unless we wanted to fight the Civil War all over again, we were going to leave the unmarked burial ground for the time being, and we were going to work on Love. And it was such an incredible invitation to all of us to work on cleaning up Love, to getting access to Love, to finding out who the owners of Love were, how do we get in, what is the combination. Love is a tiny burial ground, 1.6 acres. It's probably, the chief archaeologist for the state thinks, probably 2 to 3 times larger than that. But what shows within the boundaries of the survey is 1.6 acres. And it's encircled by, it's been fenced in inside a private hunting ground. It's stocked with elk and deer. And at first, we were all very upset to discover that somebody had fenced Love in, because in Texas, I'm not sure about Georgia law, but in Texas, the land belongs to the dead, fittingly. And you cannot sell or transfer the title to a cemetery. It only belongs to the dead and to the descendants of their families. So Love, in fact, was deeded in 1904 by Della Love, who was an African-American woman, landowner, in 1904, who deeded out that parcel to the Love Colored Burial Association, which obviously was pre-existing. And that's the way the deed was written and why we recently went back and had it resurveyed, so that we could prove the boundaries, because the old deed had missing information. Well, here is love fenced inside this hunting ground that, as I said, first we were upset by, but now I'm grateful for, because it's a 10-foot-high fence that's locked. So love is kept private. And that parcel of the hunting ground is then surrounded by a larger parcel of East Texas timber, of pines, pine farms, really, and probably 2,500 to 3,000 acres of pine around it. The first landowner that we dealt with, so we have two lock gates to get through. And the first landowner of the outer parcel was actually a big U.S. corporation back east. And they actually were helpful and helped us track down the owner and told us who they sold the parcel to so we could find the owner of the inner parcel. Since in the last couple of years or so, that they've given up their forest holdings, sold to a local corporation, and when we were there in March to have the survey done, 2 days before we were going to have the survey done, oddly enough, my friend Doris got a call from somebody at the corporation saying, well, you all can't go back in there. We've changed the locks unless you buy $1 million worth of general liability insurance before Saturday. This is on a Wednesday. That was the message. Well, Doris works full-time, as many of us do, and she didn't get the message really until Friday, and she called me, and who'd come into town for this survey, and said, China, we've something about $1 million to get into the cemetery? Will you please call and find out what this was about? She was working a shift at the hospital, so I called, and so here it is the day before we're going to go into the cemetery, and we're locked out. So because it's a small town, and because the lawyer's son played soccer with my cousin's son, I was able to convince the gentleman to allow me personally to indemnify their entire corporation so we could go into the cemetery the next morning and get the survey done, which was the basic legal protection that was necessary for the cemetery. And now that's been done, and it's entered in the court records, and we're still locked out. So love is an ongoing project, and that's why we have the Keepers of Love. It's not only the work in East Texas, but it's also, I think, sharing this model that we've come to in this particular community, in this situation, isn't going to be something that works for everybody. But by coming together with the Boy Scouts and members of the African American community, both in Marshall that do not have any relatives buried there but that care about history, and the volunteers and family members, we've come up with a way of working together and working on reconciliation without ever really talking about working that we're working on reconciliation, without getting into our heads. It's a model where we work by deed, not by word. They left the words to me, and you'll find them in the book. They wanted this story, the love community wanted this story written and documented, and we're very happy that the story will be known now and told. The book just came out last week, so it's very new, and I hope you do have a chance to look at it. It has a resource section in the back so you can find out about other reconciliation projects that are going on all over the country. The Keepers of Love are part of a regional alliance that actually started here in Atlanta out of Emory University. I'm sure many of you have heard of STAR, Southern Truth and Racial Reconciliation. We're part of that group that comes under the umbrella of the University of Mississippi's William Winter Institute for Racial Reconciliation. There'll be a meeting here in November to plan a national conference, either for next year or the year after. So Keepers of Love and Love Cemetery is part of something much, much larger. Today, I had the good fortune, from someone who came to a reading the other night at a bookstore, to be invited to go out to Flat Rock Archives. I haven't forgotten. I'm going to read a passage. At Flat Rock is an historic black cemetery that you have right here in the southern part of DeKalb County. There are actually two black cemeteries out there, but we only had time to go to one today. It's an amazing project. There was incredible synchronicity in hearing about their project. It is so similar to Love Cemetery, except they're not locked out. However, they too are having trouble with access because of the private land that they have to cross. So I want to give out their phone number, and I have a flyer about their project, which I'll share with people after we get through here. But I want to ask, before I read this passage, I'd like to ask three people, if you would be willing to say, you know, within three sentences or less, what in particular drew you to coming here tonight? Why you came to this lecture or our talk or reading? Why not the one last night? Or maybe you've come to both. But what drew you tonight? Sir, what is your name? I know I've met most of the people. Hadn't had the chance.
Larry.
Larry.
Yes.
Thank you, Larry.
My name is Benjamin. He's from Buffalo. He's from Buffalo. Or Edge Lincoln.
Very nearby, Marshall, right. He was saying that he's from East Texas. His family's from East Texas, from his father's family. Wonderful. So you were curious. Great. Someone else? Everyone's named Calhoun. Yeah. Well, there are lots of families in this part of Texas that are, we have the Black Loves, and the Della Loves family is both black and white, as was her father's parentage. And there's so many families that you've got the Black Scots and the White Scots. And I imagine that's true of Georgia, too. Someone else? Mark.
What was your expertise in religion and anthropology? You had mentioned you met with the Dalai Lama. That made me interested in hearing your talk.
Why, thank you. My interview with His Holiness the Dalai Lama is in this book. Let me just say that though I loved reading that I'd written a work of anthropology, I'm not an anthropologist by trade. I'm a writer, I'm a theologian, I'm a storyteller, and a keeper of love, I hope. So there is a lot of anthropology in here, there's a lot of history in this book, because I care about what happened. And as Manning Marable, the remarkable African-American historian at Columbia University, says, in order to have a common future, we have to reconstruct our common past. And so much of what emerged in this book is the commonness of that path, the black and the white versions of history. Most of us are only taught a very limited, narrow view of American history that's full of this mythic longing of being these innocent, struggling settlers who came to this country. And we don't tell the full truth of that story, that we came to this country, we stole the native land and almost destroyed the entire native population, and then we brought people from Africa to work the land for free to us, certainly not to them. So this is part of the history and the reconstruction effort I invite you to join in order to begin to tell the truth about our history, just as when you're growing up. You know, your parents seem like gods to you, and then there comes a point where you see they have feet of clay. I think that's part of where we are in our country. It's time that we acknowledge our feet of clay. And though the United States, as a government, has never apologized for slavery, we now have even Alabama voting in their state legislature to make a comprehensive apology for slavery. So leads into the passage I'm going to read. Unless there was one other person, I asked for three and I got two. One other person that was willing to say why you came? Were you about to raise your hand?
This is the Chinese question that was going to be about it. I have mentioned the way in life, we're all teenagers now, and I try to, sometimes I get tired of hearing some things, but I don't like them not to hear about how things work. I mean, I know
the history. Of the past.
I mean, especially like hearing about career courageous people, or I don't think people would understand that.
They don't have a context for Dr. King and the Freedom Riders and James. Thank you. Thank you for bringing that up. As Annie Fisher, one of my African-American friends in Marshall, who has no family buried in love, but who's always there to work with us said, you know, I said, Annie, why are you so interested that you would come? You don't even have family here. She works full-time, has a big job, a lot of responsibility in the community. She's a very dedicated member of the larger community. And she said, because what I was taught about our history is, like, I knew about Rosa Parks, Dr. King, civil rights movement, and not a great deal more than that. She said, I'm hungry for my history. We all want to know our history. And part of what I discovered as a white person telling the story of our effort to reclaim Love Cemetery is that it's my history too. My family arrived in 1900. They had never owned slaves. That gave me some sort of naive idea that therefore our hands were clean, as though what followed slavery, it went immediately to jobs with good wages and health insurance, which was absolutely not true. My family didn't pay wages to the field hands until the 1940s, I discovered, to my surprise. What was even more so, at first I was very embarrassed and I didn't really want to know that story, but I finally knew in good conscience I had to find out. And I don't know a lot about it. I've never seen the documentation, but what I discovered is after slavery, then there was debt bondage and debt peonage and the store system, and this was a common system throughout the South. In an attempt to control black movement and labor and to keep labor free for, you know, for wealth, so that wealth could be built. So I began to understand how, even though I didn't think I had a part in this story, in fact, I did. And some of the people who are buried in Love Cemetery, it turns out, used to work for my family. And that wisteria that grew up in the 4 months between when we saw it at the end of winter and the middle of summer was planted by people who had taken cuttings from my family's nursery, which wasn't far away, to decorate and beautify the graves in Love Cemetery. So I discovered I was a lot more related to this community than I'd realized and had a much bigger part of this story than I'd ever known when I started writing it and when these ancestors began to haunt me. I'm going to read from the 8th chapter. It's called Shiloh. And in this chapter, I'm sitting in the black church, Shiloh Baptist Church, over in Scottsville, Texas, which is a tiny place. It's a church I started going to because a lot of my friends at Love Cemetery attend that church. So one Sunday, it was Pentecost Sunday, as a matter of fact, which is celebrated in the Christian tradition as the Sunday in which, after Christ had died and had ascended into heaven, according to that tradition, the Spirit descended on the apostles and the disciples. And they left the room above where they had been having supper when the Spirit whirled into the room and set them to speaking in tongues of fire. And they left that room speaking in tongues. And that's where that tradition of speaking in tongues comes from. So I'm sitting in Shiloh in East Texas, and it's Pentecost Sunday. And I'm listening to a powerful woman preacher talking about pride and how much emphasis we put on coming to church in our Sunday best, but we don't clean up our hearts, we clean up our clothes. And it's time to clean up our hearts. That's right, I thought, thinking to myself, it's pride. She's speaking to me as well. She was also talking about how we have to love people, even when they hurt us, that no matter what, we have to love. This is my struggle, I say to myself. She's right on it, exhorting us, encouraging me, encouraging all of us to keep choosing love, to be willing to be uncomfortable. I have to give up my pride. I have to not know how Love Cemetery is going to turn out. I have to keep choosing a vision of reconciliation and healing, even though there have been rifts and anger, even though I don't know how to bring this about, even though I cannot possibly, one person, bring this about. People have to want this. Is this just some crazy idea of mine? Let go, I tell myself. I have to keep choosing my friendships. You got to love, the preacher thunders now, raining down the memory of Sam Atkins on me. Sam Atkins was the grandfather of some friends of mine in East Texas. He'd been in slavery, and they'd taken care of him in his old age. And my friend Mabel told me that one day she came in from work. This was in the 80s when I first met Mabel and Leon Rivers. Mabel told me how she'd come in from a fishing camp where she worked as a maid, slamming that screen door, hollering and saying, "I hate white people. I hate white people. They're just so mean." And her grandfather-in-law, Sam Adkins, was sitting off in the corner, rocking, reading his Bible like he always did. And Sam got up out of his chair, she told me. Old, old, frail man now, and he had his Bible in his hand, and all the pages were about to slip out, so he's holding it almost like a cup. And he said, got up to his full height, and he said, "Mabel, you got to choose love. You got to choose it, even when there's reason to hate. Hate dries you up and makes your heart bitter. Mabel, choose love. Choose it." So Sam is really the tutelary spirit of this book, who often sat on my shoulder and reminded me that was the task. How could we clean up love and reclaim love if we weren't choosing love when there was reason to hate? That's not the whole passage. So love despite the pain, choosing love, as Sam said. We all know how easy it is to love people who are like us and how difficult it is to love those whom we consider enemies. A month before this Pentecost Day at Shiloh, I'd led a retreat for 50 people in Charleston, South Carolina. There were 2 African-American women and 48 white participants. Feeling myself carried away by the call and response in Shiloh Baptist Church, the ebb and flow of rhythmic voices, I let myself remember how boldly those 2 African-American women had spoken that Sunday morning, a month before in April, the last day of our gathering, how they described the pain of being black in a white-dominated society. Elena Shakur was a painter, an African-American woman from Charleston with 3 daughters. Elena, a tall, elegant woman in her mid-60s, with short silver hair, large brown eyes, and a high forehead and warm brown skin, explained to us that she had been hugely invested in cross-cultural dialogue and racial understanding most of her life. She told us, 40 years ago, I helped start a group called the Panel of American Women, made up of black, white, and Jewish women. We met weekly for 10 years and spoke publicly about our different experiences of prejudice all over the North Shore and Chicago communities. I've always been passionately committed to racial reconciliation. 30 years have passed now since I began that work. She said, looking around the room that morning in April at the almost all white faces, and I see that in many ways we're as separate as ever. All these years later, after starting another short-lived group in South Carolina after she moved there, Elena that morning felt close to despair. The state of affairs between races in our country is still bad, she said. Quote, no matter what the appearance, there's a level at which white people don't only not understand racism, they don't care. They just don't get it, she said, and corrected herself. You don't get it, she said, speaking directly to us. She was no longer protecting us from her sorrow and her anger. I almost didn't come back to this group today. I felt like I needed to retreat into the black community. There's just too much whiteness for me here. So I went for a walk just now. That's why I was late this morning. I'd found that beautiful black wrought iron gate by Philip Simmons, the famous Charleston black artisan, that's near here, and I just stood there holding on to it, holding on to that beautiful blackness. Then Cookie Washington spoke up. Cookie was a fabric artist, a quilter, and a seamstress, a diminutive African-American woman with her hair covered by a beautiful turban. She began to weep the moment she opened her mouth. I feel that what most of my white sisters' commitment to racial healing stops at the front door. I feel so sad when white women still say to me, "You speak so well," as though they're surprised. Have you people never met an educated black woman? Sometimes I feel like your token black friend. I'm not seen as a mother, an artist, or as a friend. I was stunned by Cookie and Elena's honesty. I had never had an African-American woman friend open up to me in this way before, much less in front of a group of white people. Tears welled up and embarrassed me. They were the ones who were hurt. Why was I crying? But as I looked around, I could see that almost everyone else in the room was moved to tears, too, by their candor and honesty. People were talking softly amongst themselves. One of the other participants from the Northeast was relieved that we were finally talking about race. She felt that it was here. It was the elephant in the American living room. Finally, my friend Bonnie O'Neill, who lives here in Atlanta, who gave a glorious party for me Sunday night, and Cookie and Elena drove me down from Charleston and were at the party with me. It was a great pleasure. Edith was there too. Bonnie began to speak, her blue eyes glistening with tears. She turned to Cookie and Elena and said to them directly, "I'm sorry for the racism in our country. I'm so sorry. I know it's terrible. You know it. We all know it in one way or the other." And then she paused. "I'm so sorry," she said directly to Cookie and Elena. "I'm so sorry for any way in which I have participated in racism, consciously or unconsciously. Please forgive me. I'm truly sorry." At that, Elena, ever composed herself, began to let tears roll down her cheeks. Cookie cried even harder, and we all did, but they were tears of connection and tears of release, not sorrow. We were no longer trying to act like this pain was not between us. As if we did not intimately feel the corrosive touch of a past that is still so much present. It's the pain of our stitched together American democracy, torn and coming unraveled. People began to approach Cookie and Elena one by one off to the side to offer their own apologies, to ask for forgiveness. I asked everyone to stop right where they were. I asked Elena and Cookie if they would be willing to become the center, if they would step into the middle of the room and let those who felt so moved approach them where we could all witness and hear what was being said. This was an extraordinary moment. It should not be happening on the periphery. They were willing to hear our apologies. A small, blonde, blue-eyed woman came up to Elaine and Cookie, a woman whom I had dismissed in my own mind as a well-to-do housewife who had nothing to do. She began to tell them how she had spent 11 years working full-time with young African-American men in prison, and how it had torn her up, and how she'd seen their pain, and how it had destroyed them, and she saw all the obstacles in front of them, and how the criminal justice system really worked. It killed their hope, and it killed hers. She apologized to Elena and Cookie, and they accepted her apology, listening, taking in everything she said, the three of them now holding each other in tears. I was startled by the depth of the feeling of this woman and brought up short by my own shallowness and my assumptions about her. Another woman apologized because she said her grandparents had taught her that she didn't have to worry about black people or pray for them because they didn't have souls. Now, this is a contemporary of mine or younger who was brought up by her grandparents to believe that other people, if they had a different skin color, didn't have souls. She said she knew it was wrong, even instinctively as a child, and yet she believed it, and she was sorry for that today. Over and over, I heard, "I'm sorry, please forgive me," and I began to think, so this is what it means to speak in tongues. This Sunday, I'm now sitting again, and I bring myself back into the room. It's Pentecost, but Pentecost for me had already come the month before in Charleston. The Spirit had been with us that morning, and it was here now at Shiloh Baptist Church, and suddenly I find myself standing up, swaying with the crowd, clapping as the choir is singing. As the choir is singing and we're on our feet and the organist is playing and a percussionist is playing, maybe within 10 minutes of one another, about three different people fall out or are slain by the Spirit, whatever is going on with them is so beautifully incorporated and protected and shepherded. in the community. Nobody is alarmed. They just include her. And I think about the church that I was raised in and how, had I done that, I would have been ushered out very quickly and told to collect myself and don't ever behave that way in church and so on and so forth. Maybe some of you have been raised in a church like that. So I recognize that place of being filled with God and that fullness of feeling that these women were calling out before they fell out or started to stumble as they walked up the aisle calling for Jesus. There was no embarrassment and no hurrying out. And it was very moving to see how people were cared for. The heat in the room grows as more and more people keep shouting for Jesus. The woman up front who went into a trance is quietly wiping her face now. And my friend Doris, who's a nurse, had gone around to check and be sure that everyone was well. The room is covered, as the Quakers say, meaning that there's a palpable sense of the spirit in the room, a benevolence that surrounds us all. These women were cocooned in a profound acceptance. Pastor McCain steps back up to the pulpit, the leader of the church, and says, "The church is open now. Does anyone have something to say?" My hand shoots up. I can't stop myself. Pastor McCain does not see me. I drop my hand to my lap. Then in a moment, it shoots up again. I need to speak. Mrs. Maddox on my left sees me, gets his attention, signals to him. Finally, he nods and invites me to speak. I get to my feet, unsure of what I'm going to say. And as soon as I open my mouth, I feel this heat rise up from the floor, sweeping over me, washing away my words, leaving me defenseless, standing there speechless and bare. I let go of my pride. I may not have an opportunity like this again. I want to tell everyone about what just happened in Charleston. But as soon as I try, I feel this heat leave. I try to tell them about what we've been doing at Locust Grove and Blossom Hall and Love Cemetery. It's right in their neighborhood. I want them to know that African Americans have been part of every story I've written since 1977. But that's not what I need to say either. I want to speak so badly, but the words won't come out. Not words that will release me, only words that take me farther and farther away from what it is I have to say. I stop mid-sentence, cut myself off, and say, "Here's the point." My voice thickens with feeling, and I feel that heat coming back. My voice cracks. I'm struggling. A man steps forward to help, comes up beside me now in the pew and hands me a microphone and asks me if it would help. And I say, no, thanks. I'll speak up. He puts the mic in my hand anyway, but by now I'm barely aware of my surroundings. I feel so hot. I'm burning and my palms are wet. My voice breaks again as I try to speak, only this time I breathe and I push through that crack and I say, "I know we live in a racist society. I know there's racism of all kinds. White against black, black against white, black against black, black against brown, brown against red, yellow, green, every color. Racism abounds and it is endless, and it's racism that's wrong." Suddenly I realized how simple it is to just speak up. "I'm sorry for my part in racism. I'm sorry for anything racist that I have done for your people to hurt you, consciously or unconsciously," just as I'd heard Bonnie say the month before. Suddenly, I'm aware that now Doris has come up behind me, her left palm warm and strong against the small of my back. I feel her support flowing into me, and I am so glad not to be standing there alone anymore. I apologize. Please forgive me. I take the tissue Doris offers and I thank her. And I look around at this room full of faces. Some are friendly, some are inscrutable, some are familiar, some are not. Many I don't know. Doris continues to stand there and leans over and says, "It's all right, China." "Yes," I say, "it's all right." After the service, a few people come up to me and shake my hand and greet me for the first time. No one makes a fuss or says much except R.D., whom you met, saw, her brother. He comes up and gives me a big smile and says approvingly, "That was beautiful, baby, that was beautiful," and goes on out the church, going on about his day. Then a young girl, maybe 6 years old, comes up to me with her clear, bright eyes, fresh young face, in her ice blue dress and simply gives me a big hug. I lean down and take her hand and say, "Why, thank you. My name is China, like the country. What is your name?" "My name is Russia, like the country." Then she adds, "It's spelled R-U-S-S-Y-A, Russia." It's the end of that chapter. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I've dropped cards all over the floor as I've been speaking, reading. Does anyone have any questions before I start to tell you about Flat Rock? Larry, I think you were first.
Well,
will you speak up so we can all hear? Indemnify? Indemnify. Hold harmless. Okay.
Well, I wanted to ask you, isn't there some rule that I just assumed that cemeteries had an easement?
You just assumed what?
That cemeteries had
Has an easement.
That you can always get to.
That's the theory. That's the theory. And the law is, at least in Texas, and I think it's similar here, but I was finding out today, maybe not exactly, but that no matter how much private property you have to cross in Texas, you have the right to do that, to go back to your ancestor's grave. It says reasonable access. So, you know, there's lots of interpretation. And it's true that in this particular case, there is not only a deed to this land and has it been surveyed, there is an easement to it. There's a valid easement. But that's not always the case. And some people's cemeteries and burial grounds are landlocked. Technically, they need to be able to cross that private land. But if somebody's got a lock on that gate, it's on you to go enforce that. That's pretty intimidating. It's costly. The state of Texas went to bat for a black family who there was a recalcitrant white owner who wouldn't let them on the property, and theirs was landlocked. And they had every right to go back there and maintain that cemetery. And he fought the state. The state took up the people's side. And they won in court. And he appealed it. Just kept going. And he continued to lose. And he spent a lot of money. But it's that kind of ill will that is the true barrier. That lack of understanding. Perhaps that fear of finding out. Maybe it's his family too. You never know. Especially in the South. So that leads into Flat Rock Archive, the Flat Rock Cemetery that I saw today, which is a very wonderfully historic site. But we had to go up someone's driveway. One of the people who's working with this project, it's a nonprofit right here in Atlanta, outside Atlanta, had to call ahead, talk to the woman whose driveway we had to go up, and let her know that they were coming. And that's sort of a courtesy, and let them know how many people. And the good thing about being out in the woods like we are is that we're not disturbing someone's private home. It was very ironic to me that this was a black neighborhood, that they were having trouble passing through to get access to their ancestors' burial ground. It was supremely ironic. I'm going to give you their phone number. I promised I would let you know. Just and I will tell you how to get in touch with your local effort at Flat Rock. Because what we discovered today that was so exciting, here it was solstice, first day of summer, and one of the things you'll discover in our book, in my book, is that I finally got the chief archaeologist for the state of Texas to come up once we got in the land cleared to where they could bring in a magnetometer, a machine that the state owns, to see if we could see any other graves. He says that the cemetery actually goes back to the 1820s, 1830s, as many of these do, that this love was built on top of or around an existing slave cemetery, so that it's very old and very important historically. I lost my train of thought. I got back into love. Oh, I know what it is. We because Mrs. Britton's grandmother is not only African-American, Lizzie Sparks, she's Native American. One of the things that we began to learn is that there may be other Native American burials in the cemetery, too, and how interlinked the African-American and Native American communities are. So today, we were able to have with us, when this all happened spontaneously after a book reading the other night, it just sort of all fell together today, that a medicine man from the Creek Nation drove down from the mountains north of here to go with us out to the cemetery. And at 2:08, when the solstice occurred, there were 4 African Americans, 3 white folks, and a Native American, all in ceremony together, honoring the ancestors today. And there is an African American videographer for this project. It's being documented. They have a website. Go to arabiamountain.org, and you can find out about what's going on here and support this amazing project. So we immediately began to talk about collaborating, and the fact that next month in New York, the African Burial Ground Project, which was 20,000 remains, 5 acres, they're estimating, under Broadway, Wall Street, downtown Manhattan. When they were excavating for a federal building, the new federal building in 1991, they came across this slave and freedman cemetery going back to the 17th century in New York, in Manhattan. People don't realize, and the New York Historical Society has been running, I think, 2 concurrent exhibits, one right after the other, on slavery in New York, because so many of us are so naive, we didn't realize that, you know, there were people enslaved all over this country, not just in the South. This is not a Southern burden. This is an American dilemma. So that cemetery, they had smuggled about 400 remains out, and somebody blew the whistle, and that project has now become not only famous and enormous, but it's been made into a national monument. George Bush turned it into a national monument, and they're doing the final reinterment this summer. And the Flat Rock folks and I are going to be there together. So there's a movement to honor the ancestors. It's as though the bones won't be quiet anymore. You know, they keep turning up as buildings are dug up, and has actually reinterred 1,100 remains, the Dallas Freedmen's Memorial, city of Dallas, where I grew up. When they built the freeway, they went in and bulldozed the black cemetery, ground up the headstones, and it's used in roadbed for Central Expressway to downtown Dallas. But in the 80s, when they wanted to widen it, by then the African-American community in the historical preservation movement had united, and they said, no, you're not going to do this again. So that's another story. They did a documentary on that. It's now a beautiful memorial park. If you're ever in Dallas, go see it. It's profoundly moving to be there. So there's a lot of work to be done, and the bones are turning up. And it's time to honor these ancestors, to know who they are, and tell the stories to the next generation. That's so interesting you asked. I kept the record of what the original survey said that was drawn out, but in fact, we had to reach a compromise. I mean, Mrs. Britton and Mrs. Vitato chose to reach a compromise, and they were really pretty much boxed in. The outer land, it's the gate to it is relatively close to Love Cemetery, because the man who bought it said he always knew somebody would come back to see their ancestors in that cemetery because it was so beautiful, and it's at the top of a hill, and he said it was the most beautiful place on his property. But in fact, he built a pond. He took a little creek and pond and made a lake for the animals he keeps there and also to fish in. And in fact, the truth is that that lake ate up some of the cemetery. And then he built a boat shed over another part of the original survey. Now, he didn't have the original survey that I know of. So Mrs. Britton and Mrs. Vitato, the choice was changing the boundaries, but also the original survey would have left out some of the grave markers that were put up, you know, up until the 1960s. So their choice was to include those and to give up some of the other, I don't remember what the footage was, and to take in another piece, another part of another parcel. So it was a compromise. And it was very interesting to observe that process, and I was told that we could not file the original deed and survey in the courthouse, only the one that is agreed to now. So that's what you'll see, but I kept the plan of the way it was, the original survey, and I'm sure some of the other family members have it too. Thank you for asking. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you for coming.